Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. I'm Stephen Sexton. In this special episode, Rachel talks to Ian Archer, the Grammy-nominated musician who has written and produced for artists such as Snow Patrol, Jake Bugg, Liam Gallagher, and James Bay. He has received 2 Ivor Novello Awards and a 3rd nomination. As well as his critically acclaimed solo career, Ian is a member of the band Tired Pony. Rachel also talks to Lisa McGee, the stage and screenwriter. Born in Derry, she studied drama at Queen's University Belfast. She was writer on attachment with the Royal National Theatre in London in 2006. Her plays include Girls and Dolls, for which she won the Stuart Parker Trust New Playwright Bursary, and Jump, which has been adapted into a film. Lisa is the writer and creator behind hit Channel 4 sitcoms London Irish and Derry Girls. Both were Seamus Heaney Centre Fellows in 2019, along with Lucy Caldwell.
We don't need click track.
We do not need that.
Yeah. No metronome required today. Thankfully, it is every other day for me. But like,
would you mind just introducing yourself and telling us what you do?
I'm Ian Archer, and I'm a songwriter, producer, record producer, and I'm still a practicing artist. Like, I haven't made a record in a while, but I'm a solo artist, and appear in the old band as well.
The old band, who happened to have a huge stage at Ward Park at the weekend. Were you playing with them at the weekend?
No, I didn't play with Snow Patrol, but I went on stage with Foy Vance. And
oh, excellent.
He invited my wife, Miriam, and I out to sing Guiding Light with him, which was
Lovely.
Very cool. Very nice, you know. It's nice to get out there. It's kind of always surreal to walk on stage at Ward Park. I learned to ride my bike on the path right in front of the stage. It's kind of weird, but fantastic, you know.
As well as all that, you're, of course, the Seamus Heaney Centre Fellow alongside Lucy Caldwell, novelist and stage and screenwriter Lisa McGee. And you've been with us, along with them, since the start of the year, I suppose. How has that been? How have you found it?
It's been lovely. I think being in the company of Lisa and Lucy and having those conversations that cross all of our different disciplines, it's really inspiring for me, actually. I really like being exposed to ideas that come from outside of my little corner, you know. So that's been quite exciting, actually. And also, it is a real honour, and I do count it a privilege, and I'm grateful to be invited in as a kind of, you know, songwriter involved in whatever you want to call it, popular music or rock and roll or whatever it is, you know. So it's a lovely thing to come in and share in those conversations, you know, and be able to take something away from it too. So I really enjoyed that.
I know you've been working particularly closely with a couple of our poetry students who are obviously working with lyrics and looking at sort of rhythms of language in that way. But there's, I mean, our drama writing, script writing students and people writing for stage and screen and so on have to think about the sound and music element as well. Mm-hmm. So do you have any sort of key pieces of advice that you want to just emphasise or hammer home to any aspiring writers or songwriters?
Yeah, I mean, there have been really some little elements, some little nuggets that have, that ring true for me now that probably seem sort of incredibly simplistic and practical. Like, so much of the time for me, it's been about showing up and even to, you know, events or opportunities. Another thing, an A&R guy, the head of a label that I was signed to called Play It Again, Sam, and brilliantly sort of random character, John Dyer. And John said to me one day, the thing is, Ian, you need to realise that you only need 3 good days a year and everything's going to be all right, you know. And it was the managing of my expectations and sort of helping me to learn and manage my expectations of what should be happening in any given moment. And as an artist of any walk, you're constantly hungry for validation or for the moments that show that you're kind of on the right path. But I realized certainly in the area that I work in that actually things only coalesce like very sporadically and rarely, and when they do, it's a really key day. And if you get
all those other days,
all the
are
other
there
days contribute.
Get you there.
Every other day contributes, even if it's misspent. You know, you're on your way there. And actually, it's really, really rung true for me because you're so dependent in my area anyway. Like I'd say, actually, in any sort of area of creativity, you're so dependent on the other people doing a very, very good job, along with you doing a very, very good job. That it's a rare thing when those moments happen, but they do come around if you stick around, you know.
That's something that's come up with each of the fellow, with Lucy and Lisa as well, and at our talk with the students yesterday, that idea of accepting, building in time for procrastination and for failing and for going around the houses on things and throwing stuff away and starting again.
Mm-hmm. The editorial, you know, self-editing process is a huge part of it, and being brave with that and somehow developing a thick skin for yourself, like to be able to dispose of anything that's just dead weight in the work. There's also an operation of trying to like construct a couple of walls for a little while, keep the inner critic out, get ahead of steam, you know, talk yourself up, finish a piece of work, and then let the voice, you know, all those voices are important, you know. I have these, like, I love it when I sit down and play something back with people in a room, because you don't even need anyone to comment, really. Like, you can sort of create a recording and then invite a couple of people in and say, let the place do you, and put it on and sit with them, and suddenly just hear it
through other people's
differently.
Ears.
I'll be like, all right, come back in a week and I'll, you know, and I need to tweak a few things, you know.
To what Lisa was saying about the importance of putting on, staging things, seeing them on the stage and seeing, you've got to get it out there at a certain point to test it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What else have you been working on? What's keeping you awake at night?
I've been producing a lot over the last while. So I've been making a record for a very young artist from America, 17-year-old artist called Sammy Brew, who's on his second album.
Oh, wow.
So I wrote pretty much the entire record, co-wrote the entire record with Sammy in the States, kind of darting back and forward to Nashville last year in LA, and was really excited that then I was able to complete and produce the record in Brighton. Most of the time I work with an artist because they need a killer song, basically. And so the record label a lot of the time are responsible for contacting me and saying, will you
give us
work
a hit
with this artist and let's create a piece of work that will jump every hurdle in front of it, you know. Part of the reason I get, you know, I get asked to do that with certain artists because I'm not really... There are other people who create absolute massive pop smashes, you know. Like I would probably come from it trying to sort of with two objectives at least, you know. So a lot of it is about maintaining real creative integrity of the artist. Yeah, I really like the process of really trying to help and to sort of magnify an artist's individuality and their personality and trying to kind of create a piece of work that really reflects that. So, but
it's a really generous job to, you know, because it's going to be their hit. And of course you've won it and you've won lots of awards for the songs that other people have performed. And and I'm sure you get a great sense of fulfillment from that. But it still feels to me, it feels like a really generous thing to do to kind of figure out what that person's creative practice is and use your own to sort of develop that.
It's interesting. Like it's like a kind of a really beautiful puzzle to me that I really enjoy trying to kind of, or it's like something that we unlock together, you know, with an artist doing that, you know, like, you know, like with James Bay, we got to a song eventually called Hold Back the River that we wrote together, and that became, you know, a very big song for both of us, but especially for James as a performer, you know. But it's like a lot of conversation goes into that, like more than people would imagine. It's not as much of a musical pursuit as it is really getting under the skin of what his deep concerns are, you know, and what really, really matters. Because the funny thing is that I've discovered along the way is that when we write something that artist deeply cares about, the minute they perform it as well, and so much is in the performance and what happens when they get on a microphone, you know, and if it is absolutely coming from their experience, then something magical happens in the performance too. Sometimes it's something that artists haven't quite clocked in almost in their artistic voice, especially early on as an artist, you know. It was like working with Jake Bug, early on with Jake. He came in and was telling me all these stories. You know, they're almost, you know, they turned out to be very macabre, kind of like, there's some really difficult and dark stories in that record. But actually there was a real, you know, comic storytelling to how Jake would come in and just tell me what was going on in the council estate this week and what had happened and all the antics that he got up to and, you know, and all of the struggles his friends were going through, and gangsters and drug dealers, and just this myriad sort of picture of stuff that was going on. But then he would play me the songs that he'd written that week, and none of it would reflect any of that. They were really, really beautiful love songs, and it was kind of, you know, immediately you go and This is a whole, your entire world, you know. What would happen if we did?
Let's try and crack that open.
If we created something that reflected the reality of your life, you know, when that started to unlock as a little bit of a vision, and realizing that Jake's voice could so embody those stories as well, you know, because it won't always work, but somehow it all started to form, you know, and so we wrote pretty much the whole record together, and I produced a lot of it as well. I'll also produce work that I don't write on, like I'm working on a Snow Patrol reworked record this year as well, and producing that with the band, and that is reworks of all of the big songs, you know. So I'm really enjoying that. It's actually lovely to just be back at base camp for them, kind of building something.
Back to your banger roots.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like we're there on the road, I'm back in my studio, we're just bouncing stuff back and forward all the time and creating this new picture of some older songs. So that's a fun project. Kaiser Chiefs record coming out later in the year as well. So I've been kind of writing and producing Kaiser Chiefs as well. So that's another fun, fun project.
Maybe this is one of the bits on the cycle, which we talked about yesterday. There's a cycle when you produce things and when you research things, when you produce things, when you release them into the world and crash for a while. Yeah. Stuff. So this is, you're about to face another crash by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
All these things go out.
It's all so cyclic. It's a strange thing about songwriting for sure, that and collaborative songwriting, that really you create the work, it goes into somebody else's hands, you're really forgotten at that point, and it just goes off and gets played or done with or exists for a while or recorded or, you know, and we'll see the light of day. And sometimes I won't hear from anyone even that it's going on a record. You know, it's kind of like it just the song just has a life after that. But there's something beautiful about that too, that like it's, you know, my, especially on the writing side, like I just put that finite amount of effort into it and then it just goes somewhere. You know, and it can have a phenomenal life, you know. The songs can just live and live and live, and more and more people play them. And especially now that YouTube exists, you can just have like gazillions of people playing the song for their friends on, you know, it's just kind of this constant life of a song,
and it's playing at their wedding,
exactly,
at all their
significant
life events.
Absolutely, all these covers bands who play the song, whatever, you know, it lives out there in all sorts of ways that you don't even have access to or have any awareness of, you know. So that's kind of surreal, but really lovely, you know.
I'm Lisa McGee. I'm one of the Seamus Heaney Fellows. I'm a screenwriter, originally from Derry, now living in London. And my latest TV show is a comedy on Channel 4 called Derry Girls.
So you're a fellow along with one of the Heaney Centre fellows along with Lucy Caldwell and Ian Archer, and with us since the start of the year. And from our perspective, it's been fantastic, and from the students' perspectives. But how has it been for you?
It's amazing because it's really special for me because I studied here. So, you know, to be back as a sort of professional advising students that are hopeful to have a career in writing like I once was, you know, is brilliant. And
you can recognise that eager look in their eyes.
Yeah, and I just think it reminds you, it's reminded me why I wanted to do it as well. And it's been brilliant just speaking to some of them about their work and their ambitions for it. And it's a two-way thing. I always think when you do anything like this, you learn as much from the people starting out, you know, on their career path as a writer as they do from me, you know, if they learn anything from me.
And we talked yesterday as well about, with a lot of the students, about the importance of seeing yourself as a writer, and part of that is being listened to and being taken seriously by other writers.
One of them said to me, so, you know, could I call myself a writer? And I was like, yeah, of course, you're writing, you're a writer, you're on an MA in creative writing at Queen's, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it's always that thing that it's such a strange career path that even when you've been doing it a long time, it's quite odd to say that's what you do for a living. It's been brilliant for me reading their work and talking about such a variety of you know, like prose and plays and poetry as well.
Yeah.
You know, like it's been a learning experience for me as well.
Do you have any key pieces of advice for early career writers?
I think it's a very, it sounds very simple, but getting something finished and getting to the end of something is really important. Not to just give up when something you're working on feels tricky or at the first hurdle. Pushing through something and finishing a script, and then not sitting on that for too long, getting it out there, get people reading it and talking about it. And then the next step, I would say, is finding the people you want to work with and the people who share your vision for the project. And that can be difficult to navigate because at the start you just want anyone that likes it. You're just like, yeah, I'll work with you. That's great. But I think knowing those people, it will make it better and that, you know, are on your side in that way.
Yeah. In your case, is that other people who read your work, or is it producers? Or
it's been producers for me. So I have an agent who's brilliant, but for me, that creative feedback really comes from a couple of producers I've worked with throughout my entire career in television. And I think you come back to those people. I have probably, you know, three or four people I work with all the time, both in drama and comedy. And just because I trust them and they get my work. And I've, you know, there's lots of exciting people making television, but it's important that the people you work with love what you're doing as much as you do, love your script as much as you do, you know.
You write for stage and screen, and some that start life on the stage and then move to films and so on. Is that quite common?
I began writing plays because it was it was what I grew up with and what I'd been studying at Queen's, and it felt natural to write a play. And also it was something I could be in control of. I could put that play on, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what me and some fellow graduates did after I left Queen's. It didn't require a lot of money to do a production of something in a pub somewhere in Belfast, you know. So then I moved onto television and kind of fell in love with that long form, you know. You can tell a story over 8 hours.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So I don't write as much theatre as I used to, and that's never been intentional, really. It was just a natural sort of progression that once I moved onto TV, I started working on more and more telly, and then I kind of have stayed there.
Yeah.
And I really do love it, you know. I really, and it's changing all the time, and the standard is so ridiculously high now with all these, on-demand services that we have, and, you know, just the sheer volume of, you know, TVs that's coming at us now from all around the world. So I think it's a really exciting medium at the minute.
Yeah, we talked yesterday with Lucy, and it came up there about the importance of having something to compete with, like competing with yourself or with a network of peers or with the rest of the industry, and having to up your game constantly.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And when you see something brilliant, it's really exciting because it spurs you on. You're not going to... Everything at the minute is making me want to work a bit harder and challenge myself, because everyone, most TV writers right now are really, really good. They're the best they've ever been. So it's like... it's hard to keep up sometimes, but it's a good thing, I think.
Do you think that your theatrical sort of, your theatre background has influenced your television writing?
I'm so glad I started in theatre, because something I hadn't even realised is if I had gone straight in and started working on a TV show without having done any theatre work, my voice wouldn't be... been considered as interesting to the industry, which is terrible, really, because just because you haven't written a play doesn't mean... But there's something about being a playwright that's taken very seriously in television, right. You know. And even though I was putting on plays out of necessity, not, you know, it was just what I felt. I just wanted to write drama first and foremost, you know. It really sort of stood me well because people took me seriously and read my plays before they hired me on TV shows and stuff. So it's been good in that respect. And it also just helped me develop my voice before I went onto a writer's room with all our writers and had it diluted, which I think can happen as well. I knew how I sounded, you know, through my work in theatre.
You write young women at a particular age and geographical location so well. We had that group of American students from Villanova in March who love Derry Girls. Like, it absolutely translates since it got picked up by Netflix, of course, as well at the end of last year.
I think it's always something I've been very interested in. Not even interested in, just naturally did, was write, female leads. And it's just something I've did. It was felt that's what I should do, you know. And write them truthfully. And I think that's all Derry Girls. A lot of people ask me how, you know, why I think it's connected so well with women, particularly four young girls in the show. And I think it's just because they're not perfect, you know, and they're messy and they're just doing the things that traditionally I think only male characters have been allowed to do, and women like seeing women do those things and, you know, really be proper leads, really be flawed and terrible. And and I think a lot of people recognise themselves in those girls, you know. So I don't think it's anything huge. It's just sort of telling it like, you know, how it was for me and my friends.
It's a really nice sideways look at that period in history. I mean, it's not a sort of troubles show.
No.
It just happens to be set then, and it infiltrates life in the way that it did.
That's the sort of terrible tagline me and my producers had for it, which we've never used because it's so awful. But just sometimes it helps to keep it in your head. Was you know, there's the troubles, but these are the real troubles, you know, which was obviously stuff like not getting a boyfriend or, you know, having fallen out with your best friend or whatever. And that's how it felt like to me as a teenager. Like, I was aware of it. It was on the news all the time. It was all anybody seemed to be talking about. But I was so wrapped up in myself and my friends and, you know, that it was background noise. And so I think sometimes it punches through. As it does, you know, when something really big happened. But most of the time they're just running about being terrible people, getting into trouble.
What have you been working on besides, obviously the fellowship doesn't take up all of your time.
No.
What have you been working on during that particular period?
So Derry Girls 3, I'm writing at the minute. Or I should be writing at the minute. And I've also written a thriller with my husband's a writer as well, which hopefully we'll start filming soonish.
Oh, wow.
A 4-part thriller. I'm at the moment quite interested in original, trying to I'm very, very interested in doing Northern Irish stuff. And I think the time's right now and I'm in a good position to maybe do something else set here. And just because I think we've been really underserved, you know, I don't think there's been enough drama or comedy that's come out of here. And there's so many stories here and it's such a funny place and has such a rich history that I'm definitely interested in concentrating on a lot of things I get offered aren't obviously Northern Irish, you know, but I definitely want to try and focus on that for a bit and try and tell another, be a very different story from Derry Girls, but another sort of Northern Irish focused thing.
Oh, wow. Is it quite a shift trying to work from Derry Girls to with characters that you probably know and love by now and that's very, very funny to a thriller that's at a very different pace?
It is, but it's a nice break, I suppose, talking about it because it's different problems, really. Mm. So not having to be funny is quite nice, yeah. You know, because it just has to be, you know, a good story, good characters.
Is it set here as well?
Interesting dialogue, yeah. You know, and some in Donegal.
Right.
So mostly in Donegal, yeah. But it's nice because I often, when I'm writing for Derry Girls, I'll often wander off and my brain will wander and think of drama ideas because I'm tired of thinking of punchlines or, you know, and I think that's sort of typical of everyone. You always want to do what you're not, you know, you always, yeah. The grass is always greener, isn't it?
The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room by Ian Sansom, Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. With thanks to producer Chantal Aylesby and to Nick Boyle for his music.